Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, this one I am very excited about, Tomas Mars from the band Phoenix, and we are going to blow the lid off the French Touch punk connection. Call me Popeye, baby. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to head over to the email address, turnoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com, you can send emails to me, and that is through my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. And thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this show. And once again, he will get those messages to me. You can also contact me on Instagram or Twitter, or find me, I should say, on Instagram or Twitter, at LeftfordDamian. I'm so excited. I'm just stumbling over this intro this week. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them know that we have this podcast, and we uncover things like the fact that the French Touch music movement came out of punk. You know, that's the kind of work we're doing here on this podcast. You can also support this podcast by heading over to turnedoutapunk.com and grabbing a t-shirt. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to everyone who does do that. Very much appreciated. You can also support the show by subscribing to it or rating it on your platform of choice. And a huge thank you to everyone who does that. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. We have a website over there at fuckedup.cc. You can find out all sorts of information about upcoming shows. We got two shows in Toronto this weekend. We're going to be playing only stuff from the pre-2005 era of this band. So just kind of like 7 inches back to, we're not doing demo songs, but just kind of after the demo. So that period of the band, we're going to be playing two shows in 1978, Dundas Street West. I think it's just called 1978, the venue. And I'm very excited to be playing those. So come out and see those shows. Also, we announced this week that we are going to be putting out a brand new record called One Day on our buddies, our family, Merge Records. And I'm very excited for you to hear this record. We recorded it. I actually recorded my vocals over the course of a few days, because if I yelled for 24 hours straight, you'd have a lot of songs that were just gasping for air at the end. But it was recorded over 24-hour periods and written over 24-hour periods, and I'm very excited for you to hear this thing. And that'll be coming out in the near future. Wait, I think that's coming out in January. January. Find out more information over there at fuckedup.cc. You can do pre-orders for all that stuff. All right, on to today's show. Here's what I'm excited about. Today on the show, Tomas Mars from the band Phoenix is on the show. Phoenix, of course, are an incredible rock group out of Paris that have been, a rock group, indie group, alternative group. They also have electronic elements to it too. And of course, there's that sort of French house DNA running through it a little bit too. But there's also been this kind of punk edge that I've always picked up in it. And judging by the bands they take on tour, they do have sort of an ear for this kind of world. So when they reached out to come on the show, oh my gosh, was I excited, because we were finally going to make it happen. And whoo, I don't want to spoil this for you, but there are some things for us to discuss at the end of this episode. There are some great things that are going to come out in this episode for everyone. I feel like maybe I'm overselling it, but for me, this is why I do this thing. Oh boy. All right. Once again, Phoenix has a brand new album, Alpha Zulu, which is going to be coming out next week. If you're listening to this when this thing first drops, but on November the 4th, it will be available everywhere. It is a fantastic record, judging by the singles that have dropped, and one featuring Ezra from Vampire Weekend, who has been ducking this show. I got to find a way to get him on the show, because, there's some punk stuff there. But anyway, back to Alpha Zulu. The song with Ezra is fantastic. They're an incredible band. I really do love this band. So this has been really fun to kind of find out all about Tomas. But anyway, I will let you listen to this thing. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Tomas Mars on Turned Out a Punk. Tomas, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm a big fan, and I briefly waved to you one time at a concert in Toronto where Waves was opening up. We were backstage consuming large amounts of cannabis, and you guys were there with your family, so we did not want to intrude, but I did I did wave as we walked by the dressing room, so it's good to finally have an exchange.
Waves, yeah, I remember those. Yeah, they were great. They were like super fun to that was a fun tour thanks to them.
The life of the party kind of vibe with Nathan and stuff. So, well, it's good to finally sit down and talk to you about punk music, which is a favorite topic of mine. And also I got to ask you about so many different things about French culture and French music, because it is a culture that I am fascinated by and painfully underinformed about, you know, so I can't wait to get there.
I feel the same. I'm definitely not an authority on punk, but I have to tell you that being from Versailles, it kind of redefines punk music, because anything you do is punk, you know? It's such an establishment, it's such a, that even listening to music that's not like Baroque, you know, that's not like something from the 17th or 18th century, is a punk move. It makes you feel punk until you go to Paris, and then you feel like, no, you're this posh kid. That's not... But it's all, yeah, it depends where you put the ratio. It's all relative.
Well, I think we get a little bit of, you know, French punk history trickling over here because of Quebec and records that would circulate into Quebec and then circulate sort of through the rest of Canada. But, you know, I've been a fan of like Metal Urbain. Like, I just think all the French culture that does sort of percolate out and make it out over here, I'm always fascinated by it. Because like you're saying, it seems like a tougher road to kind of hoe for some reason for youth culture to get out there. And until, you know, that sort of revolution that happens in the late 90s, early 2000s, where there is sort of this cultural shift where the international spotlight, film and music wise, kind of returns to France.
Yeah, I mean, I see it growing up in France. I see it as there was a shift, that there was like a tipping point that... that growing up, you had to have an identity. You needed to be ridiculously true to your team. You know, you needed to have one. And I've always felt frustrated with this, but it was also because there was very little music coming out of France, and we were just consuming. So it was an identity. And then at some point, all of a sudden, when you're able to do music in your bedroom, you know, you don't need the professional studios. You don't need all of a sudden you have recording equipment. You have stuff that you can do in your basement or in your bedroom. Then all these walls and all these influences can be assimilated, and you hear it. You'd be, I mean, maybe not, but I was surprised that all these bands that came out and when we came out or a little before in the 90s that defined like the French touch had all punk influences, you know, that they all had those records. And it's just, you didn't need to be true to your team anymore. You could have a bit of everything. You could have, so for instance, for us, the first record we ever did had a song called Party Time, which is our version of punk, which is just like a 2 minute 40 really raw and loud jam of us in our basement. And then on our album, we had a song that was, you know, we would put every style next to each other. So we had that song. Then we had like a electronic ballad with a saxophone. Then there was like a Guitar Hero song. Then it was like a ballad. There was a Beach Boy. So we like to play with those styles and But before all these bands came out, there was a real punk scene in even in Versailles. Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you about that song City Lights. Is that sample or those samples in City Lights? Are they from Gods of Times Square, or what movie is that from?
So City Lights is the B-side of our first 7-inch vinyl that we put out. The A-side was Party Time. Mm-hmm. And the second one, we did a Moody, and we had those CDs that were sound. They were called like Hollywood Edge, I think.
Okay.
There were free sounds that you could use for editing, you know, a commercial, a movie. Or so there are a few sounds on City Lights that are sounds that you hear in every single Hollywood movie because they are free of rights, yeah. You know? So there's like the sound of a prostitute that's just like, hey, babe, you want to go out? You want to go out, honey? Now I watch like, records.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear it on record. It's probably like an American Gigolo. It's probably in, you know, in Pretty Woman. I don't know. It's song. And there's a bunch of song of sounds on City Lights, only on that song, I think. There's like five or six that are everywhere.
Okay. Yeah, it does have that real, you know, kind of gritty realism to it. And obviously those are American samples, but it does kind of remind me of Lahane and sort of the sort of like Paris realism thing that was happening at that time. Which people were kind of talking about a lot. Like, you know, I was studying film a little bit, so I was hearing about it. And you see that in like I Stand Alone and sort of this sort of like, I don't know, it felt like there was this real divide. And I think that's so fantastic about the music that kind of, that you guys are making, because it kind of walks this divide where there is sort of this like, at the same time, there's like I Stand Alone and Lahane, there's Amelie. And sort of there's sort of like this sort of like fantasy version of Paris. And then there's sort of this like gritty, hard-nosed, real version of Paris.
Yeah. I mean, Amelie, I couldn't stand. You know, for me, it was like, it was just not to be, it just, even the how do you call telecinema, the color timing looked like, there was an era in France where color timing was, I felt like they couldn't do really art. So they put art was happening at color timing. So everything looked like, looks like piss, yellow and green. And it's the most... art is not, color timing is just a process to make it. It'd be like if at mastering, if your creativity comes out at mastering, you know, and when you make a record, that's not when it should happen. But Lahane was great because we had the new wave, you know, all of a sudden people started bringing the cameras. They didn't need movie sets anymore. So like Truffaut would go on the street and film in real apartments everywhere. With even Romer would ask people to come in their real clothes. You know, there was no set. So any Romer movie you see, the actors are wearing their clothes. And then Lahane was a continuity of this because it's suddenly it went in the suburbs, which was a place where, you know, you'd see on the news only for, you know, you'd only see on the news because there were some events there and there was some tension, and but you never see a sort of not glorified but like an aesthetic point of view from what was built from those what they call HLM, like those projects, you know. And so Lahane was a really incredible fresh, you know, like all of a sudden that landscape became something aesthetic and a source of creativity. And
it's funny you mentioned the color, I guess, correction stuff that was going on at that time and sort of the early onset digital kind of manipulation in film. And I remember Godard writing these articles condemning that sort of stuff at that time and just saying how this was sort of the oncoming of this sort of fakeness in cinema. And there were unbelievable...
I'd love to read these. I've never heard Godard speak about this, but I'd love to read these because I'm not a filmmaker and I was offended, so filmmakers must have been freaking out.
Well, it's interesting too, because like I remember there was like also rhetoric or film essays at the time about Amelie being quote unquote fascist cinema, and the idea that they're presenting this sort of idealized version of things that's sort of in complete adversarial relationship of what art should be, and sort of like exposing the truth. And so it's interesting to hear you kind of echo these sort of sentiments about this film, because it is such a beloved indie, quote unquote, indie film over here, And I guess it was not received in the same way.
No, I mean, it's one of these that it's one of these things that plays on cliches, and so it's different, you know, to when you see it as a French person. I think you're like, okay, you're also one of our band members lived exactly where Amélie on Rue des Martyrs, exactly at that Rue Le Pic. And so the cafe is the one that's downstairs, every single thing. And, you know, his first reaction is like, what is this? Like, this is not, you could have a vision and you could be the person and see like the world with your eyes and everything. But to him, his reaction was like, this is just a lie. You know, it's not that it's a fantasy or that there's something cute about it. It's just that this is, he was doubting every step of that process, but it was artistic, you know, it was clever in some other ways. It had qualities of, you know, how it would bring the Parisian landscape and the photo booth, all these things that existed in Paris, that were the cafe world and everything. That there was something real or aesthetic about it, but it was not just, yeah, I don't know. We didn't love it as much for sure as foreigners loved it.
Doberman, though, also I thought had some weird color things going on. And I think that's before Amélie. So it's interesting. I guess that was like a, it was also happening in music videos at the time too, like the sort of like blown out colors and sort of the, just sort of, yeah, like it was, once again, very adversarial, I guess, to French New Wave.
Yeah. And that makes me think of that usually the way it works is that in France, you'd have something that's successful in France, and then the second wave makes it outside. But doesn't, for France, it has been, it was with music, our generation was successful outside of France and then made it back to France. But it was the same with cinema. When you see like Diva from Benex, for instance,
yeah.
Diva was not a it's a classic on Criterion, on a lot of American people know this movie. French people know this movie. They do, but it's less of a cult film than everything that copied it and followed. Whether it's like Besson movies, like that, some are great, some are like Subway or the other name, or The Big Blue and all these. But that 80s aesthetic that started with Diva, that was copied with other movies, was more known outside of France before it was embraced in France, which is very surprising.
It's the same in Canada. Like the stuff that you have to, you have to get kind of accepted somewhere else before the Canadian world will accept you. And it's amazing stuff.
That's comforting to know.
Yeah. I guess it's probably like that. I guess we all have sort of a cultural inferiority compared to, you know, America in a way.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
It takes America or England embracing it in Canada for things to be kind of embraced.
But Diva is still not seen as, you know, it didn't come back and it doesn't get the credit it deserves as being, because when you watch all these other movies that are done afterwards, they are such a copy of Diva. You know, the actors are the same, the sets are the same, the music is very similar, and it's almost like French people don't want to acknowledge the fact that it existed before. They don't want to look back at the past and see like, oh, we didn't see that as, or they don't want to acknowledge that so many people copied, and they want to, I don't know, but there is something a little, there's a bit of a injustice there, I feel like.
Is it like that with music? Like, are bands like Stinky Toys and Extra Ball and Metal Urbane, are they celebrated in the way they kind of should be?
It's hard for me to, I feel like there's people that started great things that got the credit they deserved after, but they never were embraced fully. You know, like Eli and Jacquenot, for instance. You know, Jacquenot, who was, so that's a great, Jacquenot was G-A-C-N-O. He was in bands. He was like a this cross between a punk kid and like a little posh, because for him being posh was a punk attitude. So he was on his Vespa with Ellie, which was this like blondie type of girl who's now still married to Brian De Palma, I think.
Oh, wow.
So she was like a really like a model who had also a great voice. So like eye candy for like they were on TV a lot because she looked great. And he was like this mod kid who would ride a Vespa, but was all influenced by punk. And their songs were very minimal. And they had EPs where it was like Rectangle, Triangle was a song, Circle was a song. They had a whole thing, and there's really great songs. And they got credit later on. I think they were a little popular before, and then the you know, a band like Air and ourselves or other bands would often quote them as great, you know, because they were great visually. They had great album covers. They had great, you know, they were the first ones that would make a synth look elegant, you know, like when you had a synthetizer before, there was like Kraftwerk and them who could make it look like a piece of art and not just like some shitty thing that you don't want anything to do with, like with the cross, you know. They had like see-through glass, transparent Vista light thing that was made perfectly. And somehow, yeah, I think Jacquenot was a punk guy because he started as a punk guy, and his attitude was really, you know, it was shocking to see him in those TV shows in France. It was like, it was as shocking as seeing, you know, when you watch those interviews of punk bands on British television when they're so, it was the same thing, that it was, there was a tension, and you would think like, okay, he's there by some miracle, and where's the huge pop star that should be there, and he took their place for a second.
Yeah, that's an interesting moment too, in like sort of like the, I assume it's like sort of late 70s, really early 80s, right, where he's on TV.
Yeah.
Or is it, yeah, like that, where that moment where, like you're saying, it bubbles through, and you have so many great classic moments of mainstream TV where they would somehow book a punk band and it would just be very awkward or violent in some way, or you know, interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, you had like, I mean, when Led Zeppelin came to France, they played a show in front of a retirement community and at the radio, you know, not only when they came to, their sound was loud and it was seen as like something that was, you know, just for French people, something that was like just loud and violent but they played, people that would come to France would play at Radio France, which has this building that the crowd that would go there would be these people that had tickets, season tickets. So the crowd would be like 60 plus, you know, very conservative, very, and once a month you'd have, and you can watch it on YouTube, you see like Led Zeppelin play in front of this crowd that is like, what is this? Like, am I supposed to be enjoying this? And you have like three fans in the crowd that are lost, that are incredible because they're really into it, and they're with grandmas. It's pretty, France had these moments of like establishment versus the new that were caught on TV that were really great.
Yeah, it's such a, I don't know, like it feels like you were talking about earlier, like this moment where you had a democratization, and just sort of like in the same way the French New Wave was sort of this democratization of film where you could make a set anything and costume could be what people were wearing. In music, you had the same sort of thing where you could put out a tape, you could put out a 7-inch in some ways, you could Xerox flyers, you could, you know, there was a democratization of information that kind of happens in that first sort of punk wave. And France was on it before just about anywhere, right? Like the Pistols play, I think, played France with Stinky Toys, I think, like, or the Stinky Toys played over in England, I know, very early on.
Yeah. But
like a lot of those labels that were putting out early pub rock stuff were all French, like Skydog Records, I think it was called, or Skyhook. Anyway, they put out the Dogs anyway, and they put out Flame Groovies and stuff.
Yeah, they England was the place that all these French bands would go to because no one was, and it stayed the same for us. You know, our first few shows were in England. There was that was the place to, and you'd play like these. You know, the venues were like, they'd see like 10 shows a week. You know, there were shows in the afternoon or something. So you'd go there and that's what you expected to be, you know, the monitors, the amount of like, I mean, the monitors were not working because they were overplayed. And, but it was like a good learning experience, but that those things didn't really exist in France, or at least not to my knowledge, or maybe we never played them. You know, there were a few venues that we played later on that were a little bit like this, but it was pretty unusual.
What was your first sort of exposure to punk?
My first exposure ever in for music live shows was to punk, because I had an older brother he's 9 years older, who went to Seattle on his sophomore high school year. So it was in 83 in Seattle. Wow. It was in Federal Way, so south of Seattle. And I went to visit him because I went for 2 weeks. I was like six or something. And everything there was like, okay, this is blowing my mind. Not only the punk scene, but also the pop scene. Cause you had like, we went to see like a local, I was six and he took me, I went to like a record store or something, there was a band playing. So I saw this band, I don't remember the name, but to me at six, it was like a super violent sound. And at the same time, Prince was on TV. And so you had these two things and I was amazed with, and I came back to France and I was like, I love music. I don't know which is the best of everything I've seen, but I like everything. And so there was a girl who was sort of our sister who lived with us, anyway, she these two kids also lived with us, and she was in the punk scene. She was also older. She was like 5-6 years older than me, and she took me to see bands. That there was one called Rosa Luxemburg. There was one called Ludwig von 88. That was the punk scene. Then there was like a punk indie scene in Versailles. One a band called The Satellites. One called Oui Oui, who ended up in Oui Oui. There was Michel Gondry, who then directed the director. So he was, Air had a band called Orange that was a punk band, but then they met people from Funkadelic and Parliament, and then they started going into a funk. Anyway, there was like a clash of, but I think Ludwig von 88 was the first show I went to, and that was the punk, because it was a show with like four or five bands, but I remember Ludwig von 88 the most, and I was maybe like 9 or 10, and so I was way too young to be there. I remember I was a short kid too, so I couldn't see anything, and I was kind of scared because everybody had like Doc Martens with the, you know, cookie, so I don't know, with the steel top.
Yeah, the steel toe.
Yeah, so the steel thing was like, okay, what is this? I remember asking, like, what is this for? And it's like, oh, it's when it's no one told me it was for construction workers. It was for a fight. They were like, no, it's for a fight, because if you're in a fight, this is like, and we had people also had like, we called them American wrist, coup de poing américain, fist, American fists. Which was the, I don't know how you call them in America, but the metal thing that you wear here.
Knuckle dusters. Like, yeah, brass yes. knuckles.
So they had brass knuckles. At first they looked just like, then they started having these spikes, and you're like, this is like, so that was the vibe at that time. I was just scared. I was not in my place at the Ludwig von ADH show. But I heard a snare drum and a kick drum amplified for the first time. And that was the best thing I've ever heard.
Well, that's the thing about that 80s French punk scene. Like that's become hugely sought after by record collectors in the last few years. Like those compilations, Chaos en France, Volume 1 and 2, and Warrior Kids LPs and all that kind of stuff. Kidnap. That band Kidnap's unbelievable. They were on one of the first Max.
I don't know Kidnap. Okay.
They had that song No SS. They're on Chaos in France, Volume 2, but then they were also on the Maxim Rock and Roll, I think it's Welcome to 1984 compilation, which was sort of like one of the big first international punk compilations, and had bands from Japan, bands from France, bands from South America, and really kind of showed the global scope of hardcore. But yeah. You know, getting into that French stuff at that time, yeah, it's like a super heavy kind of violent scene from what I've read, at least.
Yeah, they were. Well, there was that show, there were skinheads, but there were redskins, what they called redskins in France. So it was a group of people that were there to beat up the skinheads. And so that girl that lived with me at the time, she was part of she was in love with one of the guys of the, it sounds like one of the guys that was in the Redskins, which now sounds, I know that in the US sounds like a super inappropriate. And, but that was the reality then, that the Redskins were the guys beating up the skinheads.
Yep.
And the Redskins were, and it was their, you know, Friday night, Saturday night was their, going to the show is just like, okay, well, are we going to see some skinheads to beat them up? But I was really young. So I went to like only a few shows, and I went enough that I don't know where my parents were, how come they let me go to these things. But I came home as like, no, next weekend I'm good. I'm not going to go. I love music, but it's not my, I think there was some, I was aware that I shouldn't be there that young or something.
With, do you think it's that violence and sort of that level of aggression that drove yourselves and, as you say, the guys from AIR to kind of find other types of music? Like, is that what, was that part of the reason that you're like, you know what, maybe I need to find something that covers more of my bases?
Either Built that something. Or... Yeah, either that or the fact that in Versailles, anything seemed like a violent, you know, you listening to Paul Anka would be incredibly violent, you know, anything. I'm just, that's the first thing that came to my mind. But anything that's maybe not Sinatra people, maybe, but anything that's music that's not Rameau or Lully, you know, traditional, if you, so us making we started the band in my basement, in my parents' basement, and we had like the basement had these like open sections, not really windows, but open sections to the sidewalk, so people would hear us rehearse. And even though we were pretty isolated on next to other houses, people would come and knock on the door and say like, what's going on? This is disturbing the... So this whole time, you know, it was a... It was a city full of Karens. Let's put it this way, so people understand today. It was nonstop restrictions, nonstop. You know, if you would call, if you would play, not just after 10 p.m. If you would play music loud, they will call the police on you at like 7:30 p.m. on a Saturday night, and the police would come and they would not say like these guys are crazy. They would, the police would say like, you guys have to stop. Mm. So yeah, it's anything seemed punk in Versailles. And then we realized that it wasn't, but I think it's more than just finding out. Our frustration was that everything was so specific, that every genre was in their thing, and we liked everything. So we wanted to mix everything. You know, I would go to the vinyl store and buy vinyls just for the artwork, not mm-hmm. for. So one day I went with Chris, we bought like Radioactivity, Kraftwerk, we bought Shaft, we bought like, what else did we get? Neu, because it was so good looking. And there was nothing coherent about, you know, they were all in different sections. So I think it's more like, yeah, putting these things. I think for Air and even Daft Punk, these are bands that we shared a lot of our record collections, were pretty similar in how wide the choices were, you know.
Yeah, because it's also with Darling, kind of the same thing. Like you can't really pin down that sound that they're doing.
Yeah, that's why they call it Daft Punk. Yeah, Darlin was Brian Wilson, punk Brian Wilson. So it was, and we played a few shows with, you know, in Versailles. We played like three shows. One of them was with Darlin, and. The brothers in the band, our dad had a camera and he taped the show, and the crowd reaction to is so funny. It's the best thing ever. You know, people are like, there's an old lady like this, but they are, because not that much happened, they're still there, like they're still watching, because they're like, what's going on? Should we call the police? Should we, how is this legal? How is the, and the reality of this show is that my dad set up that show, the one with us, Darlin, and there was another band, because he was co-owning this restaurant, and it was like the music fest in Versailles. So you're allowed to play music that day. That's the only day you're allowed to play music. So he was like, I'm going to set up a stage and you guys can play there. And we played there, but otherwise there's no way there would be any show in Versailles.
That's wild. Like, I don't think I've ever played Versailles. It's still like that today.
Versailles is, there were a few shows that came that, but they were like huge production, and they were like Pink Floyd came, Tina Turner came, and that's about it. And I'm missing one more. The Cure came. The Cure came, but later. They came when it was somehow there was a moment in French history for us where to be a fan of The Cure was shameful.
Really?
It happened for like 5 years around Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me era, and after, for like 5 years, it was like, you're a goth kid, you're a loser, you can't, which changed after that. But it's also because there was a strong reaction that people felt like, oh, they're not, it's not like the purists were like, not even Faith or 17 Seconds, they're like pornography the most. It's like, that's the album too. You should listen to, or when Pink Floyd came, it was like, no, Syd Barrett is the guy you listen to. You don't listen to Pink Floyd. That's how snobbish But yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that was not forward. But I did see the Cure "Kiss Me, Kiss Me" tour. I went to see them, and they were huge. It was in an arena, so they were already embraced by the masses.
How did the Stereolab Darling relationship come about? You know, because I find that fascinating. Like that's Huggy Bear 2's on that compilation, which is also awesome.
Yeah. No, Stereolab, they had connections with France. I don't know what they played. No, the Branco in our band was he would know. I know that I can't remember. There was just one girl in the whole scene who was on different projects. And there was a friendship between Stereolab. There was Saint-Étienne also. Had that band had a connection with in France. So there were a few British bands that would go to France. And then I think Branco went, you know, you take trips to London for the weekend. And I think he went a few weekends and he didn't have the money to buy a hotel room. So he would sleep in the parks there and get kicked out at night. Well, but I think he slept at Stereolab's apartment one night. So there was a friendship between those early rising. Yeah, but he would tell you better.
It's amazing that moment where, you know, there is sort of that international indie underground that would wind up becoming mainstream music at a certain point a few years later. But it's still kind of like at this point, you know, still the realm of fanzines and sort of just tape collectors and just sort of these little labels, 7 inches, right? Like you guys, 500 press 7 inch.
Yeah. 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 That was, I think France also, we always, all these bands, they cared a lot about how it, you know, the visual, like, even after when you had to do music video, everybody cared about how it looks, you know, how that there were so many people and friends that could mess it up if you gave them the keys, you know, to that you had no choice but to do it yourself. You know, there was otherwise it was just bad. And so we'd rather do it in a DIY thing than to just do something that doesn't look like that, looks generic. And
that's kind of the awesome thing about all your bands from, you know, from this scene that y'all came up together, is the fact that you all retain that in a way, you know, like it's still artistically uncompromising.
Yeah, I think Daft Punk told a lot also, because Thomas from Daft Punk, his dad was in the music business, and he produced a lot of bands and he knew these things, you know. And so I remember even at some point he gave us kind of a talk about like, okay, this is, don't ever sell your copyright. Don't ever, you know, like kind of how to not lose your creativity and lose your, which yeah, we all applied. The first time we met someone that, you know, selling your publishing was a thing that was super, it was the easy way for people to make money over young bands that didn't know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So as soon as we started, there were all these sharks coming and like, sell us your publishing. We want to. And so every company was interested. And then we even met one guy in France who was like, what do you want to sell your, he was trying to buy our publishing, but he said like, what do you want to sell your publishing? We're all sharks. Well, we're going to take your money and we're going to pretend to be a bank for a month. And then there's nothing to win for you in this. And he was honest, and then he regretted being honest, but it was too late. Like, we're like, okay, we're never selling our publishing.
And then you wait long enough and then you can be like James Earl Jones and just sell your voice, right? He just sold his voice to Disney.
That's creepy.
It's very weird.
That is. I mean, yeah.
Well, it makes you wonder, like, how long is it going to be before we start seeing the release of new music by dead artists, where they just use...
Yeah, well, that happened with Michael Jackson. They released the song. Yeah, they released a song. Again, I'm not the authority on, but I'm pretty sure they released a song after he died. But that was like a mashup. And you remember the Beatles' "Free as a Bird" was also a little bit of a, you know, they started messing with things that. But I think the Michael Jackson was really the next step that they started, like, you know, doing editing. You know, they can make him say whatever they want now.
Yeah, I know that's, well, it's happening in movies, right? Like that Anthony Bourdain documentary. There's that controversy about that where they
have. Yeah, that's true, yeah.
So
yeah,
I guess my Gigi Allen duets album is maybe going to see the light of day one day.
Yeah.
Did you self-release the original version of Heatwave?
No, we self-released. We didn't even... There was nowhere to release, so the 7-inch vinyl that we did on our label, we sent copies to. There was only one label that was called Source, that was out of Virgin Records, that was selling records outside of France. And so, because we were singing in English, there was a law at the time, a radio law, that said that 80% of music that was on the radio would have to be French. Mm-hmm. But that means singing French, so we were considered, you know, not French. And then those 20% was just Madonna and huge acts, so we were never on the radio, and so very few people would be interested in signing us because there was no outlet for our music. But then Source, this label, had something. They signed Air. They knew. They were just more tasteful and more curious, and they released Heatwave after we sent them the vinyl that was City Lights and Party Time. They said they created a compilation that was called Source Rocks. So they wanted us to do a rock song, and because we love to tease and sneak, you know, you can never go along with your record company or something. We did like a dance electro, you know, we did Heatwave that sounded like a French Touch.
Yeah.
And so people in the UK love that song. And after that, we did an album which had different, which wasn't the same. And so people that got confused because it was all over the place. But I remember there was one review, I think it was a Mixed Mag magazine, which was a DJ, electronic music magazine. So they heard Heatwave, they loved Heatwave, they wanted more Heatwave, and then they heard like the album that was totally different, and they gave us 0 out of 10 on their review. And that review is the best. That was the best review we've ever had. There was one review that compared us to chemotherapy.
Oh my.
It was like listening to Phoenix. It's like, I was like, this is amazing. Because you never want, especially when you start, you never want 6 out of 10. You know, you want zero is better than 10, to be zero is like you did something that someone is reacting to so strongly that there must be something good in there.
Well, you want all art, you just want people to react to it positively or negatively, you know, and like not to offend people, but like if you can upset someone just by your sonic, like what an amazing achievement. Like that's amazing. The when Bass Moi played in Quebec, someone tried to break into the projection booth and destroy the actual film itself that they were projecting. And I always thought that was my dream reaction, to provoke someone to the point where they're willing to put their liberty and destroy your work. That is you know, you've hit a nerve at that point.
Yeah. Well, you can offend the Catholic Church, and you know there's like also easy ways to make your dream happen. I think especially in Versailles, it was like a cult, you know. It was living in a cult, so it was easy to shock people.
Well, how did the police react then to like these kind of oi shows that were going on? Like, was they must have been freaked out, a bunch of like, you know, knuckle wearing skinheads walking around in steel toe boots. Like, that must have really ruffled feathers.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing the police there because they were not in Versailles. Those shows didn't happen in Versailles. Mm. They were in the area, so outside of Paris, the department that's called Yvelines. So they were like, you drive like maybe 20 minutes away and you'd be in a total different, Versailles is this one unique thing. I guess the equivalent would be, you know, if you're downtown LA and you change the block and you're in the wrong block all of a sudden, okay. Because everything is so if you would leave Versailles, you'd go behind a gas station, you'd pass the last gas station, and then all of a sudden you were in the projects, or you were and the police there was a different, there were also two kinds of police, you know, they were like, or maybe even more, there was the super non-scary police that was protecting the castle somehow. There was like one cop on his super slow motorbike. Yeah. And then there was a police that could do something. And then there was a police called the CRS, which are like the super, you know, the not anything close to what you see in the US, but still like a RoboCop type of police where they have the serious stuff. Mm-hmm. And these, I never saw these shows. The ones that would come to our place when we play music on that would make sure was either the one or two, you know, the ones that either didn't have guns or they would come and they were just on a power, acting like cowboys, but they couldn't really do much, you know, mm-hmm. They couldn't really, violence was not really something you'd, it was all like showing their power, but it was not the RoboCop style police.
Has the reception to French music changed within France since sort of the international success of, you know, yourselves and other bands?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for us, it did change, because the beginning, coming from Versailles, people assumed we were these posh kids, which we were in a way, because we were, Versailles was posh compared to, but they would not listen to the music. They were just not welcoming anything coming from Versailles. Mm. But I don't think they, so it took maybe like two albums or three albums. And then once it was successful outside of France, and we were, you know, they were, yeah, it was better. But I think the sense of justice that I feel about France more is that there was always, when, like, for instance, when Daft Punk came out, there were always two or three other bands that sounded just the same and were not nearly as good. And there were people being snobs saying like, no, these are the real, Daft Punk is too commercial, it's too bad. And these bands are now gone from the, you know, people don't talk about them. Yeah. They only talk. So history tends to, it's not always the case, but in that case with music, it tends to favor, you know, the good stuff stayed, or at least people talked about those things. And the other stuff that well, to me, that was not that good, is not mentioned anymore. But I mean, when it comes to Daft Punk, it's a joke, because now they're national heroes. You know, when they broke up, it was on primetime TV. There was a news break alert. That's how, which was unthinkable growing up. But AR caches us other. Yeah, I think we'll appreciate the, I don't know if we were ever embraced by a massive popular, you know, but we, the critics, now for sure it's easier. Also, when you get older, you're less of a threat, you know, you're more accepted. People tend to, especially in France, people tend to like give you a break, and they're like, well, maybe it's, because they're like, oh, could it be their last album? Maybe it's the last. So it's like that. That helps too. That helps people embrace you a little more, I think. It's true for me too. When I don't know. Yeah.
It's interesting because that's almost the opposite thing that happens, I find, certainly in Canada, but maybe also in America too, where there isn't sort of this growing reverence. It's almost like a growing sort of disreverence, where you're like, all right, this band's over with. Let's move on. Where it seems like, from what you're describing, it's sort of the opposite effect.
Yeah.
That happens in France.
Yeah, I think in France, it's you're new. Well, the UK wants everything new. So you're new all the time, and that's the most exciting, and you struggle to do your second album. It's all downhill from after the second album. Yes. But in France, it's a little the same. Like, you're new, it's exciting. Then you struggle, but then if you make it to after, you're kind of like a part of the, it's almost like it's like the Legion of Honor. They're like, okay, you're part of the landscape now. So, and they cherish you in the same way that they'll cherish their, we started talking about movies, but you know, their actors, even if when they behave weirdly, they'll still give them, cut them, you know, they'll still treat them like royalty. Mm-hmm. And you've seen them with people that have been Me Too'd, and that French people are still somehow put them on a pedestal. And so whether it's like Depardieu or people that did, like, you know, that went to with Putin, or like Polanski or Woody Allen, or these, they're like, now in France it's changing a bit, but for a while it was they would still put them. So I would say that protecting the, I'd say that France is a little subjective when it comes to these things, because it's not totally honest about how those careers are built and made. But there's also something about France that's really great on how art and is nurtured from the beginning. It's part of the, you know, that they now more and more open the door, that the establishment is suddenly available to all these things now. For instance, we recorded our album in the Louvre Museum. Whoa. Which is insane.
Yeah.
And they let us go there, and that would have never happened before. And so when I tell my friends here, because I live in New York City, and I tell friends here, they're amazed, that they're like, they are even amazed we have a minister of culture, you know. So they are, to them, to have a band being able to record in the Louvre is something the fact that's even a possibility is really, it's really great.
Logistically, how did that work? Like, were you in a closed off section, or did you have to like pack up the gear every day? Cause it's like, you know, it's obviously one of the busiest places on earth for.
No, museums. We had a studio there, so we could leave our stuff, and we soundproof it. And then as soon as it was ready, pandemic hit. So we were on our own in the museum for a year. It was insane.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really crazy.
That's like a really cool chill out room for a studio to have.
Yeah.
You know, not just like a TV with some DVDs.
Yeah. Before you enter the room, there was Napoleon's throne. That was the last thing we'd see. So you couldn't sit on it. You couldn't come close to it. But yeah.
It's kind of amazing too, when you look back, and like you were saying, like from yourselves to, Daft Punk to Air, like all these people that were just doing these like little punk bands, like kind of fighting against whatever the current was against them to make this sort of music, have now gone on to become cultural ambassadors, like international recognized, you know, super bands, filmmakers. Like it really is well, I guess it's the thesis of this podcast, but the idea that like these little rooms with these little tiny bands are one day going to produce people that will shift the cultural world.
Yeah, and at the same time, that was my worry about when we got in the Louvre. I was I, you know, it was strange for us because Versailles was this museum already. So we were reliving making our first album going in the Louvre because we were thinking like we're in a museum again, but this time we're welcomed. So part of me was always thinking like someone's gonna knock at the door and say it's too loud, or someone's gonna. So I wasn't totally comfortable for the first month, 2 months maybe. And then when we were accepted, we were at first I was like, we don't want to be part of the institution. You know, that might go against creativity. You know, that might be. But I think with pandemic and everything that happened, it turned out to be the opposite, that the museum became a mess of curated, left abandoned, sort of. The guards at night only would be there. So it was really an inspiring place where you could not feel the weight of the institution, but you could instead feel the timelessness of. It would lift your weight, you know. It'd be like if you go to a recording studio, you have a gold record on the wall, and that's the worst kind of pressure, you know, that you want to. And in a museum, I thought like, well, if you see something, a great piece of art, it might be intimidating, but it did the opposite. It lifted. It put things in perspective, and you're just also the people working there were. Everything but boring. You know, they knew everything about, you'd ask, they were like crazy nerds about every single detail. And that was great.
I also found the when the pandemic hit, it really affected well how I try and make art, but like how I viewed art, you know, and I felt it was a very humbling moment for me. So I think to be in a place like that, surrounded by some of the greatest pieces of art from everywhere, from all points in history, and just to see this art for what it is, you know, stripped of the idea that people are going to a museum to observe it. Like you're looking at it potentially as some of the last people that might have seen it. At certain points, it certainly felt like that here in Canada. And you're like taking this in. Like that must have, did it affect the way you approached making the record? Like if to me, it would have been, I don't know, it just seems like a really powerful kind of thing to be surrounded by outside of the fact that it's great.
And so because you're alone with the art, which it never happens, you know, and it's way better. You're seeing it every day, so you suddenly develop taste for, you know, that there's, for instance, there was an exhibit with like 60 chairs, and after seeing them for a year, there's some that you're like, okay, this is not what I like, this is what I like. So you start to have your, and you can choose your route, you can choose your era, you know, you can choose like there's a medieval room, there's like a Memphis design room, there's all these. So you can choose you're more active, you know, it's less the pressure that I was worried it was of being in a museum and being all of a sudden having to bow to everything. This was not like that. You had to, some of the pieces were under white sheets, you know, they were protected. So you had to lift them. You had to be active and do, and you would see them from a different point of view, not with a sign of like necessarily like a respect, and you were not choking under the weight of history or something. It was more friendly.
Yeah, I want, not to minimize it, but like there is that same sort of relationship to music that you get from vinyl versus listening to something on your computer, where there is that, as you're saying, you lift up that sheet, there's an active engagement. You're not just walking by this painting, taking it in, you're like revealing it. And in that process, it, you know, it changes the way you perceive that record when you put that needle on.
Yeah, it's alive, and it's and you can grasp. That's the thing, that even the sound is one thing, but also the physicality of it, the you know, the, that's the thing that bugs me even more, I think, which shouldn't be, but that there's no, you know, that there's no, sure, if you're on a, I don't know, if you're on streaming music, you can read the lyrics at the same time, you can, but there's no fetish relationship. There's a lack of something there, that's especially when you start a band, you know, you have to get it, you have to copy a few things, you have to, like, I don't know, Chris and I, we used to look at Velvet Underground pictures, or like 13th Floor Elevator, those, the back of that Easter Everywhere album.
Yes.
Even all those tiny pictures of them, I'm like, where are they? Who are these guys? You know, the sense of mystery and mystique. We copied that on United. When people see our picture of that, is exactly a copy of Easter Everywhere.
Oh, that's just awesome.
Because we wanted to be those weird, mysterious guy in the studio that, like, you don't know who took the picture, when it's the opposite of like a posed, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's, and it's also, you know, like you're saying with those records, like when you have that in your hand, in that possession, there is this, you know, like you can't just leave it behind. Like, and you know, not to, because obviously the world's changed and, you know, people have different relationships to this stuff, but like the way I watch my kids engage with media now, it's like you take it in, you leave it, you watch it again, but you don't have that stake of having that physical possession of it in your collection where you can kind of go back to it. And it's just part of your, it's part of your life.
Yeah. It's, well, the, cause some people buy vinyl now only for the physical. Some people buy vinyl, they don't even listen to vinyl. They want the cute vinyl in the bedroom, and then it's a complement to the streaming. So it's, yeah, it's a little strange that there's, but there is a, yeah, that there's, I mean, I see that every, when we go on tour, people love merch now, and I'm the, yes, same. I need, because the tickets look like shit. They look like, you know, there's no, we were lucky enough, we did something with Richard Prince, the artist, for a show that we did in Spain once. And when I talked to him, he was saying, I was trying to convince him, because he's a big shot artist and we're all not, you know, I was like, why would he want to work with us? But his first reaction was like, I still have my Woodstock ticket, you know, that's to me. So anything that would give value, and that's what he clicked on, and that's what he liked about what we did, is that there's something that you give value to, something that at least is a trace or a memory of, because today you can't keep an A4 Ticketmaster, or no one does. And even sometimes people ask us to sign these. I'm like, this is so, you know, there's a little tear when I sign up. I'm like, what is this? I'd rather reprint a set list or do a fake, you know, like something than that has more. It's nice that there's at least a few things like that are coming back that you can hold on to.
You got to do commemorative fake tickets to sell at the merch table now.
People do that, right?
Yeah, well, in wrestling, that's a big thing. In pro wrestling, I know.
They do fake, okay.
Well, like you get the ticket after you're at the event, because as you're saying, everyone's got the digital ticket now, or it's just on your phone. You're not even printing out that piece of paper. So you get a ticket once you arrive at the event of the event that you're already at, just because, yeah, if you want to save it and you want to sign it, because these things like that Woodstock ticket, they become, you know, in a way, religious artifacts. Like it's almost as like pop culture.
Yeah.
You know, it's a planted religion in a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, yeah. There are great memories of even movie tickets. You know, they used to look better. They still look, I mean, there's still the name of the movie, at least on them. And there's no, it's still a format that you can pin on your, my daughter, my youngest daughter has these on her, in her room.
Well, it's interesting to see as, you know, like these things obviously start off as personal collectibles. And then we arrive at a point where they just become collectibles. And now we're at a point where like that Woodstock ticket isn't just worth something to someone who was there. It becomes like a cherished artifact for people that weren't there. And you see that, like you're saying, with music posters and the way the secondary market is so big for people just to have a piece of the band, I guess, or a piece of the artist that they like, but
yeah,
just...
yeah. Yeah. Memorabilia is a huge, I had a, I don't really collect band t-shirts and I don't have, I have like a few posters. I only have stuff that I went to, you know, like I don't go places to, so there are more memory just for me. So I have like a good, you know, Urge Overkill poster that was meaningful to me, like a few. But there's one t-shirt I had from a Spaceman 3 t-shirt when I was 16, and I felt like with that t-shirt I wore it all the time, like a long sleeve t-shirt, Spaceman 3. And I went to see online, I wanted to just buy one because I lost mine, and they're like $600.
Yeah.
They're like, it's like how I was not aware that Spaceman 3 t-shirts were huge, but yeah, they are. So there, some things at least people have taste, but the market is a little insane.
I need a Party Time 7-inch. That's on my want list.
That I can make happen.
Well, let me know, yeah. Because I would love to get a copy of that. That's
and I will make, who are you? Let's, I'm not promising, but I'm pretty sure we have.
Okay, no pressure.
I'm pretty sure we have. So I'll try to make that happen. So how can I send this to you?
I'll send you my email address in the chat, and just let me know if you find it, because as I say, well, and also like, you know, that compilation with Darling on it, that Stereolab Huggy Bear compilation, that's like a $500 record now.
Yeah.
Like,
that I can't make happen.
Oh, so don't worry. No,
because I don't have I don't have them, but the Party Time 7-inch, I do have, they were only 500, and Chris and I, as a joke, under the sticker, we signed maybe like 15 copies. I've never encountered one that was, I looked through, I've never encountered one that was signed, but I should be able to find one for you.
That's awesome. We got revealed on the show a couple episodes ago that on the I believe it's the Negative Trend 7-inch, on the first press, there's apparently Hits of Acid hidden under the label. So
that makes sense. I'm not surprised.
The things we're revealing on this show, you know, be it signatures or acid.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't do the acid part, but you can. The stickers are so old, you can probably lick them and get a. It'll probably do something.
Well, this has been amazing. And anytime you want to come back on the show and talk about punk rock or film or whatever you want to talk about, please know the door is always open.
Thank you. That was really fun. And I'll try to, now I'm on a mission about the 7-inch. I'll try to keep my promise.
Thank you, Tomas, for coming on the show. And for those of you keeping score, plant a flag in French touch and French house music, because I think we can claim it as another thing that came out of the punk explosion. How's that? How is that? That is why I do this thing. That is why we do it. So there you go. I think that is it for this week on the show. Coming up next week on the show, speaking about why we do this thing, someone I've wanted to have on this show since I started doing the show way back when, someone I've been a fan of forever. I think one of the most important people to emerge from punk rock, someone that changed not just punk music forever with what she's done, from the band Spider and the Webs, from the band The Frumpies, from the Go Team, from Bikini Kill, from Jigsaw Fanzine, the legend Toby Vail is on the show next week. And this is a good one. This is a holy geez. I'm excited for you to hear this one. And that is it for today's show. Thank you everyone for listening. As always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter and are vital and important. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different races and people of different faiths. And we need to protect people's rights to choose what they want to do with their reproductive systems. Because none of these things are political issues. These are all human rights issues. People have the right to live free, and that's free from violence and hatred and discrimination and just free. So get involved in stuff that's affecting positive change in this world. If there's a way for you to lend your support through lending your time, lending lending money, whatever, not lending money, but donating money if you've got extra money to organizations that are doing great work, do so. That's how we change things in this world, right? Speaking of changing things, change the culture around you by producing the culture. Anyone can do this stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine. Like, who would have thought that, Daft Punk was just some punk kid starting a band. Phoenix was just some punk kid starting a band. Air was just some punk kid starting a band. Michelle Gondry was just a punk kid in a band. Who knew, right? So who knows where this leads? Start a band, start a fanzine, start a label, start just doing something, Start a podcast. This is the laziest form of doing something out there, I feel like, sometimes. For me personally, there's people that do really hard work with this. Things an albatross anyway. Make some culture. Who knows where it'll take you. And that doesn't mean, career wise or anything like that, but I mean, just even emotionally. Speaking of emotions, try meditation. I didn't believe in it. And I know people have for thousands of years. I know I'm a fool for not, but, I try it and it works for me. Maybe it'll work for you. Takes a couple times before it starts clicking, I found for myself personally. Maybe for you it'll happen sooner, and you have to remind yourself to do it. Sometimes I slip, but it's always there to go back to, which is great too, and I should be doing it more. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. They're literally dead weight at that point, and they can change someone's life. I've seen it happen firsthand. That's it. Congratulations to people in Germany on upcoming recreational legalization. And free all cannabis prisoners. Gotta say that. I should be saying that more. Free all cannabis prisoners. People shouldn't be in jail for weed. Free all drug prisoners, ultimately, obviously. But anyway, I'm just rambling now. Thank you, everyone, for listening. See you on the next episode.